the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 446 for Saturday, April 20th, 2013.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We answer your questions, we share your tips, and we haul away your cool stuff found for an awesome cool stuff found show that probably will happen next week again. But for today, it's questions and tips from you, from us, for you, for everyone here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Well, not for everyone. There's that one person.
Hey, but you, sir, and you know who you are. It's not for you.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
So Saturday today, this is I've broken the rules and I'm on my second cup of caffeine today, which is more than I usually have in like ever, you know. So I can't promise what's going to happen. But Saturday, yeah. Now I'm leaving tomorrow. We're heading to San Diego of all places for a family city vacation week just to hang out and all that good stuff. You with me here, John? Did I lose you?
I think so.
No, okay, good. All right. I've had all the caffeine. I should share some of my caffeine with you. We can, what blood type are you? Can we just like neutralize and normalize?
I don't know.
Seriously? All right. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. I got to look that up.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm sure someone knows. Yeah. All right, let's get to the show here because we've got lots of stuff
focus,
to do.
Focus, man.
Yeah, focus. So we've got questions, two sponsors today, Bare Bones, of course, and Audible coming back on board after quite a while away. So we'll talk a little bit more about them later. But right now, we will talk about Joe.
Hey, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. Joe here from Raleigh, North Carolina. Have a question that I've never heard brought up on the show before and has to be something that annoys a lot of people. In Apple's Mail app, if you receive a mail with an attachment, you can save that attachment off to a folder so that you can organize that information, and you can save the email in Mail app so that you can go back and refer to maybe some of the conversation of the email. However, there seems to be no obvious way to delete that attachment from that email before you file it, which is seeming to result in now that attachment being filed once in your folder structure and a second time in the email directory. Is there a way to delete the attachment and just save the text thread of that email, short of, you know, emailing it back to yourself and that type of thing, which obviously one can do, but just takes extra steps? There seemingly should be a way to delete the mail or delete the attachment and then just file the remaining textual content of the mail. Appreciate it a lot. Here's where you cut me off.
And cut you off we shall, Joe. And I think you're right. I think you are. I think you're spot on, because your concern probably did bother a lot of people, so much so that it bothered someone at Apple, or someone at Apple heard about it. And not only did they hear about it, they did something about it. If you highlight a message or multiple messages and go to the message menu in Mail, you will see there is a remove attachments option, and it will do exactly what you want it to do. It will take those attachments out. Now, of course, this is a manual step. You could do it to a smart mailbox if you, if you have some criteria that you want to do this on, or you probably could. I checked the mail rules. There's no obvious way to affect a remove attachments option in the as part of a mail rule. But you could, you could probably Apple script it in some way, I would think. So, but it's right there. Yeah. I had never, honestly, when I heard your question, I thought, oh, that's a great idea. And then I found it. So yeah, it's one of those things that I didn't know was there, but it's there. Any thoughts on this, John?
Now, in Mail app, isn't, I'm trying to look through the structure here, but I thought the attachments are also stored in their own folder.
Yes. So in
Mail downloads,
home library mail downloads, I think is where that goes, but not every attachment is saved there. Only attachments that you have opened, right? If it's just part of the, if it's part of the message and you never open it, it will stay just in the EMLX file, that, you know, the message file that's stored in Mail's hierarchy. If you double click it to open it, Mail has to save it somewhere. And so it saves it to the Mail downloads folder. And then it opens up in preview or whatever. And then there is a setting in Mail about what to do with those attachments afterwards. And I'm trying to look here, and I think,
there was something about, there's something in the preferences accounts advanced setting where you're keeping copies of messages for offline viewing, and you can choose all messages but omit their attachments if you want. But there's also something about what to do with Mail attachments too. And I can't, there it is. In preferences, Mail preferences general, John, if you look at the remove unedited downloads, and you can choose never, when Mail quits, or after message is deleted. So that's the copy that's in the Mail downloads folder. If you've just looked at it but haven't changed it, you can have Mail delete that when it quits, so it's not keeping yet a third copy of potential attachments, if that makes sense. Makes sense. Makes sense?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, good stuff. I run into this a lot with we use Exchange at work, and get attachments, and it keeps yelling at me that my mailbox is full, so I actually have to archive them.
Got it. Yeah.
All right, and last thing, you can tell. Now, I don't think this is on by default. Actually, I just looked at my mail installation, and it's not. But if you right click on the what do you call this bar? The bar across the top of
the toolbar.
Mail. I guess you call it that, but it has from, subject, stuff like that. If you right click on that, that'll then show you additional categories that you can display.
Not the toolbar, the column header.
Yeah, column headers.
Okay.
Yeah, if you right click on that, it'll then give you a list of all the possible ones. And actually, in my case, attachments was not on.
Aha.
And if you turn it on, then any message that has an attachment, you'll see a little, isn't that cute? A paperclip.
Yeah. And you can get there by going to the view menu and go to columns as well. One's a shortcut for the other. I don't know which we would consider. A
couple of ways to get there.
Yeah, exactly.
Why are they using a paperclip? That's so archaic.
Because it's an attachment.
Do people even know what that is?
It's the synchro
aesthetic.
What's it called? What's that term that everybody was crazy about? Apple using wood grain trim on things. I don't know. I can't think of it. It's too early on Saturday morning.
Yeah. Because one that's a real throwback, and I think Microsoft tends towards this, is using a floppy disk for a save icon. It's like,
yeah, skeuomorphic design, right? Does the paperclip fall into that? I don't know. It might. We can complain about it if it does.
Yeah. All right.
Yes. All right. So moving on to Greg, perhaps, John.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. I want to say hi, because I'm thinking maybe people in the chat room will have some answers for this next one. So I'm going to say hi to everybody in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream. Thank you for joining us on this out of sync, out of schedule, but it seems like our schedule is pretty fluid these days. So we just have a nice mix, and it happens when it happens, but it's not that fluid. I mean, it's usually Sunday at some point. This is the first one we stretched to Saturday, but you know, we have a focus on Sunday. Anyway, Greg,
Yeah. But this one's good because I think it's open discussion, because I don't think there's any one correct solution.
Right.
Here we go. Hi, John and Dave. What I would like to do is copy a playlist to a thumb drive as MP3 file so I can then transfer that music to my car's hard drive. Car with a hard drive. It's crazy talk.
My car has a hard drive.
Mine doesn't.
I know.
I think it does. Most, though not all, of my music library is in AAC format. The way I've done this in the past is to make a playlist, select all the songs in the playlist, and convert them to MP3, which is a choice in iTunes. When you highlight a song, you can say convert to MP3. Then select all the MP3 versions I just made and drag them to my thumb drive. Afterwards, my music library is full of duplicates, which I then have to clean up, which gets to be a pain if the playlist is several hundred songs long. Is there an easier way to do this? Well, here's a suggestion I threw to him. One way of doing this is create a separate library. And how do you do this?
In iTunes, you mean? Create a separate library. Okay.
Yeah. So what I'm proposing here, so have your normal library that you want to keep nice and clean, and then what you do is create another library. And how do you do this, you may ask? And I'm going to tell you. When you launch iTunes and you hold down Option,
I think you're right. Yeah.
And you hold down Option, it'll say choose iTunes library, and you get three options: quit, create library, or choose library.
Choose wisely.
Yeah. So create a library, make a new library. Then the next step would be to, you could simply just drag all the songs that you want to, or I'm sorry, do the conversion first, right? Then drag the songs, maybe into a folder on your desktop. At that point, then I guess you can whack them from the original library.
No, you could do the conversion in the new library too. There's You can do the conversion in either place, and maybe if by doing it in the second one, it keeps your main library a little easier to keep clean. Yeah.
Right. Oh, maybe that's. Oh, okay.
That's how I read your answer. It's funny, Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then, the basic concept here is that you're going to have two copies of the song. So
to do it that
putting
way.
Them in their own library is one way to separate them out. Now I'm really kind of sad that, do a lot of the car players not get AAC? I'm kind of surprised at that.
Mine doesn't. No, it's MP3 only. Huh. I tried AAC because I have exactly this problem. Cause I've got USB ports. Frankly, I've got USB ports all over my car. It's crazy. But, there's a 50 gig hard drive, I think, in my car. I mean, it's pretty big and I can load it up with music. I've only got, a couple hundred songs or something that I put in there because it's a pain in the neck. I got to copy them to USB, but I have to make them MP3 first. And since I'm an iTunes Match guy, everything that I have is 256K AAC. And I went through a similar process to what you just described here. But as you were going through this, I was reminded of something that I was dealing with sort of for an unrelated project recently. And I stumbled onto a terminal command that's very interesting, John, because Apple had traditionally stayed away from this. But the terminal command is called AF, as in audio file, convert all together, AF convert. And this will allow you to take any audio file, input to it, and it will use Core Audio, which is the same engine that's in iTunes and all that stuff, to convert the file. And I started thinking a couple of weeks ago when I sort of rebuilt or added and tweaked our podcast automator workflow, I thought, I could do it this way instead of doing it in iTunes. But I use iTunes to fill metadata and that sort of thing that's different for the show. So this wasn't quite the right thing. But for this project, it could totally be the right thing. And you could script it or automate it and drag files from iTunes to an automator action that then pump this stuff out to a folder, via this AF convert deal. And that might be a magic little trick for you. Yeah, you'd have to muck around and find the right terminal settings for AF convert to get from what you're at to what you're going to be. But once you find that, you sort of bake that into your automator action and off it goes. So that's I'm going to head down that path because
it'll take a little time to build and just get right. You know, it's like three steps or something, three actions. But just to get the, you know, the incantation right, it'll take a little bit of tweaking. So I did, tangentially, I did finally, because I've been promising it for a long time, I published an article, about how to, I mean, the how to is how to use Automator to batch rename files, but it really is a how to of Automator, and what it shows you, if you've never used Automator before, check this article out, because it shows you how quickly and easily you can build workflows in Automator to do things. You know, this workflow literally took me less than a minute to build. Now, I knew exactly what I was doing, but the fact that I built this in less than a minute and then was using it immediately, it saved me a ton of time because I had about 100 files I needed to rename. So if you're interested in Automator, go through this and then it, you know, it's kind of add to your tool set so that the next time you have something similar to do, you like, oh, I can go to Automator. So that was my tangent. I'll put that in the show notes. Go ahead, John. Yeah.
Now, lastly, I found this here and I haven't used, I used this way, way in the past, but I really haven't used it. I'll paste it in our chat room here. Sound Converter. There's a,
oh yeah.
Yeah, apparently it's free for files under a certain size. And then if, you want to convert larger files, you got to throw them, I think $15 or something. But this actually looks, I'll have to try this out, but actually this looks to support about 100 different audio formats. If you check the page for them here, huh? So huh? If you're really into converting or need to convert between different audio formats, this could do it for you.
Yeah, there's a ton of these things. I've probably yeah. Mm-hmm. Very nice. Very, very nice. I like it. Anybody in the chat room have anything to say? I'm just checking the chat room now. No. Okay. XLD. For converting, yet another app, and MLV in the chat room to my thing. So we'll put a link to XLD first, which is an app that will convert audio files thanks to GeoCost in the chat room. And then MLV in the chat room says copy the AAC files to your thumb drive first and then run AF convert on all the files they're in. So that's very cool. We'll find XLD. I love XLD. XLD is great because it allows you to convert all kinds of different things like FLAC. And I think it'll convert AUG and I mean, just SHN. I mean, very, very, you know, some of these not quite iTunes centric audio formats. It will happily convert. So.
Yeah. And lastly, you know, I don't have an install. That's right. I didn't install it on my new machine yet, but I'm sure there's also something open source. I think what you mentioned is one of them, but I like using this Fink. It's a package manager. And there's a couple of different ones here, but I'm sure there's there may be a couple of choices here if you like to dabble in the terminal for doing audio conversion, in addition to what you mentioned there, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because we're all about audio. Because if it wasn't for audio,
we wouldn't be here. That's true. Yeah, it's true.
We'd have to, or we would type everything. But yeah, that would be kind of clunky.
Speaking of typing everything, I've been writing more and more articles lately. I think I wrote like 3 or 4 articles this week. I remember that one. I don't remember the others, but they were good. They were. Freaking awesome. Oh, I did. It's, you know, I know I have to ruin it. I was going to mention it during Cool Stuff Found, but, you know how, we TiVo users, John, have used iTiVo to pull shows off of our TiVo and then bring them to our Macs and convert it. And then you can put it on your iPad or watch it on your Mac or whatever. Right.
Sure. But yeah. Oh, I saw this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
But iTiVo is really clunky. Because it was built in, not that AppleScript Studio is bad, but just the way iTiVo was built, the user interface would go unresponsive for seconds at a time. But it worked and it was totally the easiest way to do any of this. Somebody starting in December, I think it's relatively new, rewrote iTiVo or took the core of iTiVo and wrote it in Objective C. And they just came out with version 2 last week, and it's called CTiVo, you know, because it's written in C. And it's awesome. It does everything that iTiVo did and more. It'll see all your TiVos. It's what you want to. There's no question about it. And I actually found a bug with it, and they fixed it that day. I'm sure, you know, because I wrote in the article that I found a bug, but it's good. So I'll put that in the deal and the show notes. What do we call those? CTiVo. CTiVo, like TiVo.
We have one last one here.
Yeah, go.
Thanks to the chat room here. Someone mentioned this. Fission? Who makes...
Fission is from Rogue Amoeba.
Yeah, it is. Okay, there we go. Fast and lossless audio editing for Mac OS X.
It's not going to do conversion, I don't think. But what Fission does that's totally magic...
It says here, if you need to convert formats, Fission can do that too. Exclamation point. You can rapidly export or batch convert files to MP3, AAC, Apple Lossless, FLAC, AIFF, and WAV, which I would say are probably the most popular formats out there.
Yeah, right. Okay, so the cool thing that Fission does, and I didn't realize it converted because I have it, so I'm glad to know this now. But the cool thing that Fission does is it lets you edit MP3 files, which are compressed files, without uncompressing and recompressing them, a process that is naturally going to lose some data. You can actually edit MP3s without losing any data because it's not going through a double conversion process. And how Paul and his team figured out how to do this, to me, is magic. I'm sure, you know, to them, it seemed like magic, and then they figured it out. And that's why they're rock stars, you know. But yeah. Yeah, cool stuff. I love it. Oh, this is great. This is like a preview of a Cool Stuff Found show, John. All right. Speaking of Cool Stuff Found, I'll talk about our first sponsor here, John, which is Barebones. And BB Edit is the product that we are talking about. BB Edit, for those of you who don't know, is sort of the de facto standard, if you will, of text editors for the Mac. And they've been developing this forever. They're into the versions 10 of the product, and it is massively mature, has a ton of features, and they keep adding to it. But it's just, you know, I use it all day, every day, for any text editing I have to do, you know, this runs the gamut of, now for me, you know, the geekiest bit of it is, editing our PHP code for the site. And I can do this in one of two ways. I can edit, if it's something that we have stored in our repository, I can edit it locally and sync it with Git or GitHub. And that works. Or I can actually edit directly on the server. They've got an FTP and an SFTP, a secure FTP client built right into BB Edit. That's a file browser all by itself. It looks very, very similar to what you would see if you were opening a file on your hard drive, but instead you're logged into an FTP server. You pick the file or files, and you can pick multiple files at once that you want to edit. They open up in BB Edit, and then sort of BB Edit just knows that this file doesn't live locally. It lives on the FTP server. And so as you make edits and you hit Command S to save, it saves it over FTP live. So if you're editing something that's, you know, accessible live on the web from FTP, you can hit save, go to Safari, refresh, and it's right there. Don't make any mistakes, or, you know, but BB Edit has, you know, a massive undo history. So if you do make mistakes, you can easily go back and forth. It's really easy. So that's like the geeky side of things that I do. But on the flip side, you know, on the like semi non-geeky, often I need to count how many lines of text I have for something. And I paste it into BB Edit, and it's right there at the bottom. Also is the number of words right there at the bottom. And because I leave BB Edit open all the time, it's a very lightweight app. It doesn't bog down my system like, say, Word or something that could also do this. But, you know, BB Edit doesn't have formatting. It's all plain text. It will highlight code intelligently, but you're dealing with plain text. So really, really simple. I can sort things in it. And so if I have a group of text that I need to sort alphabetically or whatever, I can do that in BB Edit too. It really is my go-to app for so many things. And I highly encourage you to check it out. Barebones.com. You can download a free trial from there. When you're ready to buy, you can go to the Mac App Store and buy it, or you can buy it straight from Barebones for $50, actually $49. So, I encourage you to check it out. BB Edit from barebones.com. And we thank you for checking it out and thank them for supporting the show. So, all right, John, sort of in the, wow, this sort of harkens back to a conversation we had, not that long ago, but Scott asks a question and the question is simple. It says, John and David, Mac Geek Gab 441, you spoke about the product Clean My Mac. Can you discuss, preferably on the podcast for all to enjoy, the differences between Clean My Mac and Onyx? I use Onyx on a quasi-regular basis. Is there something Clean My Mac does that Onyx doesn't? And this is interesting. You know, I started going through the two because I thought, well, that, you know, how much crossover is there? And what I really came down to was what's the same between them? And really the only thing that's the same between them is that they both do some cache file cleaning. Onyx is very much a maintenance application where it's running system maintenance, like, you know, your daily cron scripts, your maintenance scripts. You can edit, you can reset spotlight data. You can reset mails envelope index. You can rebuild launch services, right? That's what Onyx is there for. Clean My Mac is about finding stuff on your Mac that you can get rid of and free up space. That really is sort of their, you know, prime directive of what the app does. So part of it's cache files, and that's the overflow with Onyx. But also things are finding large files or unused files on your Mac that you might not know are there. So that's one of the things it does. You can remove old iOS software updates, kind of falling into that realm of things you didn't know were there, but were taking up, you know, space. You can remove language files. And it's interesting. We asked them about this, John. Remember, you know, I was the last time we talked about Clean My Mac, I was really skeptical on the whole language file thing. And they said they have built a database of things that they know to be safe to remove, and they will only remove those things. That's what the app is it works on a whitelist, not a blacklist. So it's not like they say, don't remove these. It's only remove this stuff. And they're constantly updating that list. So that made me feel a little bit better. I still haven't pulled the trigger on it, on the language thing, but it makes me feel better telling you folks about it. So I guess I will only pull that trigger if I get to the point where I truly need the space, but that's just because I was burned in the past by a different app. It'll clean up iPhoto. And the thing I love about Clean My Mac is the way it manages the trash, because I can empty the trash on individual drives, which with a lot of drives connected is cool. So different products, and I use them both, Onyx and Clean My Mac. So that's the question.
The other thing in Clean My Mac I like, which isn't really a cleaning operation, yeah, but it helps you get an idea of what's going on in your machine, is they call it Extension Manager.
Yeah. I don't use this, but I've seen it there. So yeah, I'm curious about this.
Yeah, so they're Chrome, you know, like right now I'm looking at my system and it lists Chrome extensions, contacts, plugins. So I guess they did a lot of research here. So any program that can extend its capabilities by, you know, little plugin modules here. I mean, of course, you could just dig around in the file system and find them, but this presents it in a much, much nicer way.
Right, right.
Yeah, and you may have things that you didn't know. Like here, for example, I see in iTunes, I have a Quartz Composer Visualizer, which I don't think I even really use. So,
yeah.
Let's see. Mail plugins. Oh, well, these are things I know I have. Signature Profiler and Spam Sieve. Yeah, I know I have those. So that's actually, that actually I think is a nice feature, is that it helps you understand. Well, it can be a cleaning operation because it looks like you can disable them or toss them if you want. So, yeah, and I even saw, I think, it got a thumbs up from my wife there, Katie. I saw her tweet the other day saying, you know, I tried it and I was very happy that it cleaned up like, you know, 15 gigs and didn't seem to destroy anything. So that I think is a good endorsement.
Yeah. You know, I did a little more digging after we talked about, you know, the last time, and I don't want to go on and on about this, but just to share, and I don't have all the, I wasn't prepared to talk about this today, but it sort of, so I'm going off the cuff here, but I did a little more digging and there's more history. You know, we talked about Clean My Mac versus Mac Keeper, right? And Mac Keeper, which everybody has learned to love to hate because of their advertising. We've already had that conversation, but as a little follow-up to that, I did some digging. Apparently, the folks who started Mac Keeper is a company called Zeobit, and it was started by this guy out of college, and they did a lot of consulting stuff before they started doing Mac Keeper. And the guy who started MacPaw apparently worked there at Mac Keeper or at Zeobit. And then sort of in the early development of Mac Keeper, before Mac Keeper was released, he left to start MacPaw and do his own thing, which is, you know, how things work. And so they come from the same place. And then there's this whole thing that I really want to find out more about. But there's this whole thing about there was some. A lot of, like, in one day, there were like hundreds of negative posts about Mac Keeper posted to Apple's discussion forums. And it really, you know, killed their sales and all this stuff. But it, you know, there's a potential, you know, I love my tinfoil hat. And so I love my conspiracy theories, but you know, it's like, well, wait, who posted all this stuff? Why was this there? Was this a timed attack? It sure seems like it. And it was after that that Mac Keeper started doing their massively over, way over aggressive advertising that everybody now hates them for. So there's more to this story that I'm trying to dig into. So it's interesting. Ready to move on, John?
Ready, Freddie.
You sure? Do you have something? I know because we're doing this show today, I did most of the prep here, but we've got some questions that you prep. But if there's anything you want to chime in on, please, of course, feel free.
I'll chime.
Good. Chiming is good. All right. Going to Josh. Josh asks, I know in the past you've explained this, but could you go over again how to best migrate from using a Pop account to an IMAP account in Mail? I currently use Pop for multiple accounts, but would like to be able to synchronize my email usage on my Mac with my iPhone and my iPad. I also have a boatload of messages saved in folders on my Mac. How does this get handled? How would folders work on IMAP accounts? Also, most of my accounts are Gmail. How reliable is IMAP on Gmail accounts? Okay. So we'll answer these questions a little bit separately. First of all, it's very important to remember that in most cases, certainly in the default case, any messages in your Pop inbox, Outbox, drafts, and trash are only stored on your Mac. They are not stored on the server. Once they are downloaded to your Mac, and this is true about the inbox, once it's downloaded to your Mac, again, the default behavior of most Pop clients is to delete it from the server. Can leave it up there, but for the most part, once it's in your inbox on your Mac, it's no longer in the inbox on your server. And then anything in your sent box is never saved to the server. And that's true of drafts and trash as well. So if you were to delete your Pop account from your Mac, those things would be deleted forever. And you need to bear that in mind. So the path that I recommend is to add the IMAP account to your Mac first, and then copy the data from your Pop inbox to your IMAP inbox, from your Pop sent box to your IMAP sent box. And the same is true for trash, if you want to keep the stuff in the trash and drafts as well. And then remove the Pop account or disable it. You know, you can disable accounts in Mail by going into preferences, accounts, and then highlight the account on the account information page. Choose or uncheck enable this account. And that will also it'll keep the data temporary, you know, until you delete it. But it'll keep the data. It just won't show it to you and it won't interact with things. So that's how I would migrate things. Would you agree with that, John?
Well, that's what I went through. If you recall, mm-hmm. You know, I was a Pop type of guy for a long time and had to go through this. And the points that you bring up are important is that a normal Pop operation, a lot of data is only stored So I did, you know, exactly what you, you know, I went through the process that you did.
Right.
Or you suggested is, you know, for example, all the sense stuff, had to drag that over to the equivalent part of the IMAP account. Otherwise I would have lost it.
Right. Right. Right.
The other thing to mention about them, so of course, you know, the two popular ones here, POP and IMAP, is that you want to be sure, because none of these protocols out of the box are set up to be secure.
That's not...
So typically, you could enable it, I think at least in Mail App.
Is that not by default in Mail App? I think the secure box is checked now by default in Mail App.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But you're right. You want to make sure
may
it's
not
secure.
Support it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because and typically I think they'll use SSL, which is also used for, you know, to secure the web browser. So so you know, make sure you're doing that for you know, whenever you set up your account here in Mail App. Where is it at here? I think it's under accounts and I'll get it here in a moment. So you look at your accounts. And like, I'm going to click on Gmail here, for example,
yep.
And mailbox pay now advanced. Okay. So in the advanced tab, it says port 993. And then there's a little checkbox, use SSL.
Right. Right.
And I think you get a similar configuration option if you're doing the POP thing.
I think that's right. That's right. Yeah. 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 You definitely do. Yep. So are we good? Are we good with this, Sean?
I guess the last thing I'll mention here is that you also want to make sure. So if you're concerned about mail security is now this is security for pulling the mail from a server to you. But of course, there is another protocol that is used to send your mail. And that's SMTP. And you got to separately secure that.
That's right.
Now, that's kind of hidden in Mail App. And then if you go into Mail App and you click on an account, you will see under account information, a thing that says outgoing mail server, SMTP. And then what you want to do is go to the edit SMTP server list, and it'll list all the SMTP servers that you've set up within mail. And then if you click on the advanced tab, so it's buried a couple of layers deep here, but similarly in the advanced tab, you're going to have a little checkbox where you can set up the port and also a checkbox saying use SSL. So,
yep. Very good. One thing. So to the second part of the question, you ask, how reliable is IMAP on Gmail accounts? Well, it's fairly reliable. However, you need to understand, and this is important for any of us, whether we've got mail set up the way we want or not. We all need to remember that Gmail was not built to support IMAP. It was built to be a web interface for your mail and built to be a revolutionary web interface for your mail. And of course, we can debate whether that's true or not. But that was the intention is, you know, we had come from these mail clients where we were storing things in this, you know, hierarchical folder structure to keep track of things. And Google said, forget that. We're a search company. We believe that if you just store all your mail in one place and when you want to find it, you just search for it. And in many ways, they're right. And in fact, you can now use Mail App to do the same thing, whether or not you use Gmail. Search functionality has just gotten so much better than it was like 20 years ago. But the problem was, you know, and you could access Gmail with POP, which effectively, like we said before, lets you pull down messages from the server and just store them on your Mac. But Gmail was never built with IMAP in mind. But, you know, people wanted it. People pestered. And with mobile devices out there, you kind of have to have it. So they added it, but it was a, you know, a bolt on afterwards. And the issue with it is that IMAP, which is an older protocol than POP, I believe, John, even though we all sort of migrated in a reverse order. The way IMAP works is it connects to the server. It gets a list of folders from the server. And the assumption is that there is one copy of every message and those messages, you know, if you're going to move a message, say, from the inbox to your action items folder, it moves. And, you know, if it's in the action items folder, that same message is not also in the inbox. It is not also in your archive folder. It's in one place. That's how IMAP works. It is, you know, built on the traditional folder structure, just like you have on your Mac with your file system and all that. Gmail, again, going back to their, you know, sort of view of the world,
said, we're going to just store all your mail in one place. But if you want to apply labels to it to make it easier for you to see like all related messages together, we'll let you do that. So you can assign labels in Gmail, but there are no folders in Gmail. Well, when it came time to bolt IMAP onto to Gmail, Google, in their infinite wisdom, said, well, we'll just make labels folders. The problem is messages can exist and always exist in multiple labels. Every message is applied to a label called all mail, for obvious reasons when you're using the Gmail interface. But you can create other labels. But if you create a label, let's say I create a Mac Geekab label and an Action ASAP label. Well, if I move the message into the MGG label and then I move it into the Action ASAP label from the Gmail web interface, it's going to exist in three places. It's going to be in MGG, Action ASAP, and all mail. And it could still be in my inbox, too. So it could be in four places. That wreaks havoc when your Mac goes to check mail, because it's going to pull down four copies of this message. Now, Mail.app's gotten a little bit better at dealing with this. It will pull down all four. It will store all four, but it will only show you one of them. That said, I recommend if you're going to use IMAP to interact with Gmail, I recommend treating those folders or those labels like they are folders. The one that you're going to have trouble with is this all mail folder. Thankfully, Gmail lets you decide what labels show up to your IMAP client, and you can go into settings, labels, and turn off showing IMAP for the all mail folder or all mail label. And that will make your life easier. So there you go. That's my, but it works. You just got to jump through these hoops. I published an article on this 3 years ago and it still stands today. So I'll put that in the show notes. That was a bit more of a rant than I expected to go on, John.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you got to do it. Sometimes that's how it goes. What are we doing next here, John?
Mike?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You use that. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Okay. Well, I will read the question so people know what we're talking about. Mike says, do you have any thoughts about the Gmail IMAP thing, John, before we move on? You're ready to move on, aren't you? Okay.
No, I threw in my 3 cents.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Mike writes, I'm having problems with Parallels. It runs horribly slow. And by horribly slow, I mean taking 15 minutes or more to fully boot Windows, 5+ minutes to open a program like Word, and even 30 seconds or longer to register a mouse click. During this time, my Mac runs reasonably okay, but not great. Can you guys help me tweak my settings to get both running reasonably? And he goes through and he shows his settings in Parallels and also what his Mac is. And his Mac is a mid-2010 MacBook Pro with a 2 gigahertz i7 processor and 8 gigs of RAM. His Windows settings have RAM set to 3 gigs and the CPUs set to 4 emulated CPUs. And I think that might be part of the problem. RAM, I think, is okay on this, right, John? I mean, again, as long as he's not also running lots and lots of other RAM hungry apps.
I typically will make the RAM half of what my Mac has. So I think bumping it to 4 may not be a bad idea. And also 3 is kind of a weird number too. I don't know if it's struggling with.
We had 3 on our Macs for a while. Remember our MacBook Pros? Huh. Yeah. Cause we had those weird Sandy Bridge chips that would only support 3 gigs. And if you put the fourth gig in, it would break or whatever. I don't know.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah, but okay. I think you identified the real issue here.
Well, I think the real issue is the CPUs because it, near as I can tell and I checked Intel's specs on this, the 2.66 gigahertz i7 only has 2 cores in it. It is capable of hyper threading, which means that 4 threads can run on those 2 cores and it will show up to OS X like there are 4 cores. In things like activity monitor and iStat menus and all of that. But really, there's only 2 cores. And I think setting Windows to believe that there are 4 is probably what's causing a lot of contention there. So I would set it down to 2, honestly, or even 1. Depending on what you're doing in Windows, you may not need both cores. And it's nice to, you know, kind of let Parallels run on one and then leave the other for your Mac and all the video work that needs to kind of happen outside of Parallels. So my guess is that's the problem. But it's that's an important one to check. You really need to kind of research, what does my processor actually have and how can I best optimize that for this? And I'm, you know, as I'm saying this, I'm surprised that and maybe Parallels and VMware do some of this, you know, sort of let me check and see what you're running on and make a recommendation. And maybe he just changed it from the recommendation. But they should be, because I was just doing all that stuff with my car with Parallels and it worked. But there was never a moment where it said, hey, dum-dum, you know, if you do this, it's going to cause you trouble. They basically say we recommend and then sort of they're out of it. So that's my feeling. Thoughts, John?
The only other thought, I mean, it almost sounds like it's a hard drive issue, not a performance issue. I'm wondering about the state of the virtual disk file that he's running here. I mean, he says he has a 500 gig SATA, 180 gigs free.
Yeah. I mean, right. A disk issue, you know, would cause this. But since he says his Mac is running fine at the same time, sort of, I don't know, you know, it made me think there's something about Parallels. So I don't know. I don't know the magic answer. We try to know the magic answer. I think we both have our windows open today. Two people in the chat room are asking about the chirping birds and the trucks driving by. I think the truck was you and the birds are me. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can't tell.
My windows aren't open. I'm just close to the close to the street here.
Okay. Yeah. To me, it all sounds the same because it's in. I'm hearing what you folks hear. All I have are my earphones, and it blocks out a lot of external sound. So what I hear in my ears is basically what you know is going to tape, as it were. All right. Where are we here on time, John? Just like to get a feel for this. You know, I want to talk about our second sponsor, which is Audible. I'm so happy to have Audible back. Audiblepodcast.com/MGG is the link you want to visit. And I'll tell you why in a minute. But what you get at that link is one free month and a free book of Audible Podcast or Audible Gold. It's not Audible Podcast Gold. Audiblepodcast.com/MGG is what you go to, but it's Audible Gold. Audible is the source for so many different kinds of audio content, audiobooks, you know, and topics ranging everything. I mean, you know, you want tech books, you want fiction, you want trashy romance novels, you want comedy. It's all there. And comedy books are great. I use Audible a lot when driving home from gigs because I'll get like, you know, something engaging keeps me awake. And for an hour ride home at 3 a.m, that's a really good thing. You know, so if I'm laughing my butt off, that's actually better than me being in the car falling asleep. As long as I'm not like, you know, crying and laughing. And then, you know, I'm not focused on the road, but an appropriate amount of engaged laughter keeps me awake. But so does a good book, you know. And so I'm really happy to have Audible here. And I do use them very, very regularly. For exactly this. And one book that I was listening to lately, actually before I even knew that they were coming back on board as a sponsor, was a book that, well, frankly, John, it epitomizes what we do here or what we tell people here, especially what we tell people at the end of the show. And in the vein of Don't Get Caught, I believe sort of the poster child for that is a man named Frank Abagnale Jr. And Frank Abagnale was, the name of the book is Catch Me If You Can. And it was written by Frank. Frank went around, he posed as an airline pilot. He learned how to forge checks and figured that whole system out. He spent a career in his life, pretending to be someone he was not and sort of lived in and around and underneath the system for a long time. And then he got caught and then actually wound up helping the FBI and various companies increase their security. But it is a fascinating tale. And if you saw the movie was good. But there's it, you know, the kind of the cliche it, with this is so true. The book is so much better just because there's so much more detail and so much more cool stuff that he talks about. So so Catch Me If You Can is my book recommendation for Audible or for Audible this week. But it's audiblepodcast.com/MGG can get you this book or any book that they have for free for you to try it out. And then if you want to continue on, you continue on. So I didn't warn you of this, John, so I don't know if you have a book recommendation or not, but we'll have Audible back again. So certainly if you don't have one today, we'll have an opportunity to talk about another one down the road. Yes? No?
I don't know if they offer it, so
I'll search for it.
Put that on my
okay. Yeah. Well, that's right. Well, yeah, they have a lot of stuff, you know, the Steve Jobs book, of course, is out there. You know, there's a lot of the obvious stuff is out there too, but don't forget about sort of the fringe stuff, the stuff that's just not like the straight and narrow New York Times bestseller list stuff. Like I said, the comedians, you know, hearing somebody like Steve Martin read his own book is fantastic. So, you know, check that stuff out. There's some cool content out there that's not just part of the, you know, kind of the mindset of
oh, like I said, here we go.
Yeah, go.
All right. They have one here that one of my favorite sci-fi series, The Stainless Steel Rat by Harry Harrison.
All right. I know not of
guy's
this.
Check it out. The guy's a intergalactic agent or criminal or both.
Huh. All right. Well, yeah. I'm going to check
out.
Oh,
they got a
out.
Few of them here. They got The Stainless Steel Rat. The Stainless Steel Rat Wants You. The Stainless Steel Rat Saves the World. Oh, gosh. I think they have all of them here. Outstanding.
Huh. I may put this on. You know, I've got a long plane ride tomorrow. So, and I've got a couple of credits that I haven't used yet because I've had my account for a while. So this is good. 4 hours, 53 minutes. That's perfect for a plane ride. I like it.
And actually some of these, I've had great difficulty finding them in print. Some of them are very hard to get, but it looks like they have the whole collection here in audiobook.
Nice. What's cool about Audible is you can listen to a little snippet of the book so you can decide, you know, because some of these people, and it's a personal preference, that some of the narrators, you know, you might love and some might totally drive you crazy. So, you know, definitely check that out and then you're good to go. So audiblepodcast.com/MGG gets you a free book and gets us credit for telling you about that free book. So check it out. We'd appreciate it. Hopefully you'll appreciate it too. That's the idea. All right, John, pick where we're going next.
Oh my.
I mean, we can go to Bob. That's probably a good one. And then I'll let you pick from there. How's that sound?
Go.
Okay. So Bob has a question that we actually get asked a lot, and I'm not sure how recently or if ever we've talked about this on the show. Bob says, I have a brand new iMac and am brand new to the Mac, but I am a longtime Windows user. I used Apple's migration assistant, and it pulled everything over from my PC to my Mac, and everything's working fine. I have an iPhone 4S and an iPad 2. Both started life on my PC. Now that they live on the iMac, I am having problems syncing to the iMac either via cable or Wi-Fi. Under iTunes Wi-Fi sync on the iPhone 4S, it's trying to sync to both the PC and the Mac. The PC shows to be syncing apps, and the Mac is syncing books and tones. Under Wi-Fi sync on the iPad 2, it basically says the same thing. PC syncing apps and the iMac is syncing books and movies. Both the iPhone and the iPad are only syncing what I have listed above. I have my iPhone hooked up to the iMac and I have it syncing a full backup, but I really want to be able to sync everything to the iMac using Wi-Fi and leave the PC behind. I really don't want to have to wipe it out and go through all of that again either, because I have it using the old Google syncing that is no longer allowed. I'm afraid that if I wipe it out and start on the new iPhone and iPad, I will lose the Google syncing that I have now, and it works great. Is there any file that I can edit on the iMac anywhere that I can just point it to the iMac? Okay. So I went through this when I got either when I wiped my Mac or when I got a new Mac or something, but I went through this with at least two devices, maybe even three. And there's a scary moment, you know, when you connect a device to, you know, you've moved your iTunes library over. So all this stuff is there, but there is a scary moment when you go into the iTunes on the new Mac and you click like for apps or movies or whatever it is. And you say, I want to sync these here. And you go to check that box and it says, hey, it's syncing movies with another computer. If you sync with this one, it's going to erase everything, or it's syncing apps and it's going to erase everything. My experience 100% of the time. Now, I have to issue a caveat that Apple's warning must be there for a reason. But if I've copied the iTunes data from one computer to the other, 100% of the time I've checked that box and thrown caution to the wind and ignored the warning, it has not erased anything. I hit the button, it churns for maybe, you know, 30 seconds, and then everything's happy. It's like, yep, sync done. I'm in sync. You're in sync. I see that we're really the same thing. I didn't realize that at first, and blah, blah, blah. We're good to go. Now, it doesn't actually say all the blah, blah, blahs, but that's sort of what happens. And it's happened every time. So I think you're safe doing this. But like I said, Apple's warning's there for a reason. So you might wind up blowing away your apps, but you can always re-download them. But you'll lose your data, or you'll lose your settings, I should say. So I think you're okay. As far as the new Google versus the old Google, I use the new Google. It's fine. It really works totally fine. And I have no complaints about it. So in terms of the way you have to link with the calendars and all that stuff, it's not the, the fear factor there was sort of unwarranted. In my experience, there's no reason not to jump to the new one. So that's my feeling, but it is a little scary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, John, tell me where we're going.
You know, this one's, I think, quick and easy. Ralph.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah, take it. You're reading it.
All right. Where's the, hold on. All my windows are all over the place here. I just had it up here.
You need a second monitor.
I should get a new one. This one's right now I got a Samsung SyncMaster 191T Plus, which is quite old.
How big is it?
I should get a 19 inch.
All right. So let me tell you something. Andy from UNH told me about this earlier this week, and I haven't talked to Monoprice about it, but we all love Monoprice. And they have this 27 inch monitor for $475. That looks to be really awesome. I'll put it in the chat room in the show notes, but I wanted to ask George at Monoprice about that because, I want to see what
they
think.
Monoprice brand.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know about that. Cause you know, I mean, I gotta say I've had great experience with Monoprice with their cables.
Yep.
The one thing I would not recommend because I think it was poorly implemented was their Wi-Fi 802.11n
the
Wi-Fi
router.
Access point.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
right.
It was $20. You know, I saw it. It was a sure. sale, and I'm like, yeah, well, for $20, you know, how could you go wrong? Well,
right,
you
can't. Right.
But it would, you know, it would fail. It would drop DHCP. You would have to cycle power on it. However, their switch, their 8-port gigabit switch, which yeah. I think was also about $20 when I got it. That I'm very happy with.
Yeah, well, I haven't had anything from Monoprice that I haven't liked. In fact, I've got one thing I hadn't talked about yet, which is their full-size iPad case that has a keyboard wrapped around it, and it's cheap and it works awesome. It's a Bluetooth keyboard, kind of what your typical, you've seen these before, but it's a case. It's like a folio style case that you can just totally use. And then it's got a keyboard in the back side of it. And when you flip it open, the keyboard's right there. And it works. I've had total luck with it. It's been fantastic. In fact, I was going to move my iPad into it for our travels next week so that I've got the keyboard with me. But it was like $36. I mean, it's like totally cheap. And I've got some HDMI switch box on my TV that's been rock solid other than the really, really bright lights. But yeah, you know.
Yeah.
So I want to find out more about this.
I don't need a new monitor.
Yeah, it sounds
like I could get a second one. Because I do that at work. I have a laptop and then I have an external, I think, yeah, it's like a 29-inch screen. So I like working that way. Okay. Back to Ralph. So here's a question from Ralph. Hi, guys. I have an early 2008 Mac Pro and I'm trying to increase the hard disk speed. I have a WD-5000-AAKS-Y1-YGAO drive, which is a Western Digital drive, and I'm only getting about 60 megabytes a second write and 55 megabytes a second read using the disk speed test program by Blackmagic Design. I have an identical drive that is not being used and was wondering if you would suggest a software RAID as a way to goose up my speed and how much of throughput increase I might expect. I would like to get an SSD, but would rather not spend the coin. Yes. My answer is simple. It's certainly something to try. What you want to try, so one way you can implement RAID is through Disk Utility. And it will let you set up various types of RAID sets. And let me paste this in our room here. And this is actually the help that you get either within. Yeah, this is actually kind of interesting. I don't know if we ever mentioned this here, but a lot of the help within a lot of the Apple applications is actually also, it's actually redirecting or pulling it from their website. And as you can see here, this is the article in Disk Utility that talks about the different types of RAID and what they can do for you. And I wonder if help.apple.com is a place to start on this or not. But that's what it starts with. What happens if you go to help.apple.com? Maybe you can try that for me. So, so Stripe RAID set is what you want here. In theory, a Stripe RAID set will speed you up here because it basically distributes the reading and writing among multiple disks. And I would think that the interface in that machine in the Mac Pro would not be the bottleneck. If your interface is too slow, then that's going to slow you down. So. That's my answer to that. And they talk about it more. Check out the article and they make mention here.
Yeah.
And they give a few examples here about the different RAID sets. It's not guaranteed, but I think it is the type of RAID set that has the potential to speed things up.
Well, yeah, the idea there being you're able to write to multiple disks simultaneously. So the speed of each individual or the speed limitations of each individual disk are not, you can sort of move beyond that. That's the general concept, but it is a slow SATA bus, right? In that laptop, as I'm seeing Tom pointed out in the chat.
No, I think he said he has a Mac Pro.
Oh,
no, he has an early 2008 Mac Pro.
Okay. Okay.
If he has a Mac Pro, then I think that's probably what a SATA. Is it a SATA 3 bus? Well, how would we know this? I'm going to use my pal Mac Tracker.
There you go. Yes.
I just love to death here, and it's starting up. And let's look at the Mac Pro. Now, there's also, I think they also have, though he said he doesn't like to spend coin, but I don't know if they offer it anymore, a Apple hardware RAID card, which, of course, you'd have to pay money for.
Right.
That
would right.
certainly.
Right. Yeah, well, and the other way to do RAID is to do external RAID and buy a box that supports it, but that, of course, costs more money. RAID should make it. In theory, it can make, I think the way you said it was best, John. It can make it faster.
Yeah, let's see here. Hard drive interface, 4 3.0 gigabit per second serial SATA controllers. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's SATA 2, I guess, is the 3.0 gigabit per second.
Right. 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 Yeah. Interesting.
Oh, and here we go. Optional. Okay. And this machine could have, so maybe you can get one of these for cheap. I'm not sure, but it says internal RAID, optional Mac Pro RAID card. So this model, you could have ordered it with that, and maybe you can still get one.
I think you can.
How much those cost.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see. Mac Pro RAID card.
Let's see. Apple Store. Oh, $700. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're going to spend that money, then I'd get an SSD instead.
Or get an external RAID box.
Oh, like Synology or Drobo or...
Yeah. I mean, those are network attached RAID, right? So you could do, you could do SATA attached. You could do not with the Mac Pro. You could do Thunderbolt with other Macs. But that would be where that starts to get better. In fact, that sort of leads us into Fred's question.
Outstanding. Well, go to Fred.
We will go to Fred. Fred writes, I am stuck in an unable to decide cycle. Oh, I love these. I originally bought a ReadyNAS NV Plus 4 bay network attached storage unit, is what NAS means, several years ago to use as an iTunes media repository and central storage to back up my video, music, etc. It has been rock solid but slow and was originally the first RAID I used, flexible X-RAID. I then fell in love with Drobo, cheaper, easier to use, but Drobo has consistently let me down. I ended up giving three generation two, four bay Drobos to house my hard drives. As my collection of stuff grew, I upgraded to larger hard drives in my Mac Pro and put those old drives in my Drobo. My original ReadyNAS with 4 1-terabyte drives still just chugs along. But the Drobos have not been so consistent. Two had to be returned for failures on RMA, and while not failing, I had to wipe the two disk sets due to system file errors, which makes for a major pain in the butt. Make a long story slightly longer, I want to get rid of my Drobos at the end of 2013 because they're going to have no more support for them. But what to get? Another ReadyNAS? I've not heard great things about the newest software or hardware. I've heard much better reviews on Synology and QNAPS devices. I've narrowed my search down to a Synology 413 or 412 or even a 1512. But how does one choose? I didn't even have mention of QNAP or the myriad of other choices. Any insight based on your use of Synology, Drobo, or even other choices that have struck your fancy would be greatly appreciated. So, yeah, I've been, as we've talked about on the show and longtime listeners will know, you know, we've sort of been down the path here of starting with kind of a similar path to Fred, where we started with direct attached Drobos and have had great luck with them. And I still have great luck with my generation two Drobos, but I know that many others have not, but I've had good luck and then we moved to Drobo's network attached unit, which was the Drobo FS, and not quite as good luck there. In fact, Drobo's networking software really kind of sucks. I haven't seen the Drobo 5N yet, so I can't speak to that. But everything prior to that, the Drobo Share, the Drobo FS, the networking stacks on it were just ridiculously stupidly slow. So I got very frustrated with that. And I think you had problems with mounting it and that sort of thing, John, you know, consistent problems, right? So
it's still... if I wake a machine and it's time to do a time machine backup, it will time out. It won't appear in time. Once it's fired up and the system sees it, then everything's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my only observation because it yeah. Yeah, I mean, I keep in there. It says, you know, I can't find the Drobo.
Right.
Time machine can't find the Drobo or can't find the destination drive.
I have that all the time with my FS. Yeah, and it's frustrating. And I've still got it on the network and I use it as a time machine source or a time machine destination, I should say. But that's about it. The one thing that really excited me about the FS when it came out was this concept of what they called Drobo apps, which were apps that you could install on the Drobo FS itself. Remember this thing? I mean, it's like a little computer in there. In fact, it is. It runs Linux, and that's what manages the drives and the networking. But it can do other things, too, because the CPU has extra cycles, and it's got extra RAM. So there was this thing, you know, where you could install an iTunes server on it and this, that, and the other thing. But the apps never really took off, and the apps that they did release from Drobo stagnated, and third parties never really did it. So it didn't quite go where I wanted it to go. And then I think it was a listener of the show, frankly, that turned me on to Synology. And their NAS units do all of that and more. There's huge third-party support. Their NASs are, I mean, you want to talk about quick connections, John. It's ridiculous. And they're fast. And they're doing it right. And they, like Drobo, support doing multiple disk sets of multiple different size disks. And that's, I think, really important for people in our realm. I mean, you're not, it's not cheap. You know, you're spending somewhere between $300 and $600 for the empty unit, and then you're going to put your hard drives in it. And you don't want to be forced to use drives of all the same size for a lot of reasons. A, you've probably got different size drives around and you can capitalize on that. But the other is, if one of your drives dies or you want to expand the size of your RAID, it's really nice to be able to put in a drive of a different size and not be totally locked into, oh, no, you can only put 1 terabyte drives in this unless you copy all the data off, reformat it, and, you know, go to 2 terabyte drives. That's expensive and causes a headache. It can be more efficient and you can get slightly more speed out of it if you do that. But so I like that about the Synology. They call theirs hybrid RAID. Drobo calls theirs beyond RAID, but it's the same concept, different size disks, no problem. So I really like the Synology stuff for all of those reasons. QNAP is a lot like Synology, but the one thing, and it still makes me scratch my head about it, but it was one of their engineers that told me this. I asked him about, you know, will you support different size disks? And they said, no, we don't believe in it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, really? That's too bad, because that sort of cuts out, you know, us, you know, our family, the Mac Geekab family. And they said, yeah, we get that. But, you know, our target is our target and blah, blah, blah. So that's why I haven't even messed with the QNAP stuff. But the Synology stuff has been great. And, you know, I mean, I run all kinds of servers on there. My son has a Minecraft server. I mean, I've talked about this. It's, I run Crash Plan on it, unsupported, although I'm hoping that'll change. You know, it just works great. I can stream music to my iPhone. They have great iOS apps too. I can stream music to my iPhone from anywhere in the world directly from my Synology. So it's good stuff. So highly, highly recommend it. And they don't even pay me to say that, but that's okay. It's good stuff. So that's where we're at. Anything, any one last thing we want to do, John? This, we're getting to our normal length here.
Yeah. My clock says, 1:11.
I got 1:11 as well. So,
wow. We're in sync.
It's, yeah, imagine with time, no less, an abstract concept, as it were. Is there anything else, or is it time to bring in the band, my friend?
Yeah. Bring in that band.
Bring in the band. We can do that. So we will be, we'll be back next Sunday. I'm back from my trip on Saturday, John. So Sunday in the chat room, normal time, 5:15 ish Eastern, whatever that time tends to, you know, turn out to be, is that's when we'll be here. What do we have to say here, John?
I have something to say, and that's feedback@macgeekab.com.
feedback@macgeekab.com is the address to send your questions, comments, tips, cool stuff found. And I think we should do a cool stuff found show next week, John. How do you feel about that?
I don't know. We did one fairly recently.
The queue. Have you seen stuff found queue?
It's
crazy.
Well, I'll look.
I tell you what, I'll leave it up to you. You know what's in the queue. You just tell me, and I'll prep a little bit on Sunday morning or whatever. And, you know, after I'm back, and I'll let you manage the questions for this week, and we'll see what happens. But I think we've got a ton of cool stuff found, so it'd be cool to do one. feedback@macgeekab.com.
I was hoping you wouldn't forget.
I wouldn't. 206-666 geek, which, John, is
4335.
You bet it is. That's the phone number you can call from your phone, your iPhone, your landline. You could call it from Skype, but I wouldn't, although you could. But you can just Skype us to Mac Geek Gab, and it does the same thing anyway, and then you're not paying for your Skype out minutes. So might as well do that. Let us pay for the Skype out minutes. It's on us.
Mm-hmm. And of course, on the web, you can go to MacGeekGab.com
to see the lovingly crowdsourced, handcrafted, John F. Braun approved show notes.
We haven't mentioned this in a while. If you're on iTunes, leave a comment about the podcast.
Yeah, those iTunes comments and reviews really do help us. It sort of puts it back on Apple's radar, and then they'll feature the show. So, yeah, head to iTunes, and if you would, please, and rate us and comment. We'd appreciate that. We especially appreciate the 5-star reviews, but we want you to be honest. So, you know, speak your mind. It is your place. It's not our place. We're not allowed to speak. We each get to vote once, and I'm sure we both did that, 7 years ago. So we can't say anything there. It's up to you. That is your place. What else do we have, John? Twitter. You want to tell them about Twitter, my friend?
Twitter. There's a way to follow lots of different things on Twitter. But if you want to follow the podcast, it would be Matt Geekab. If you want to follow me, John F. Braun. If you want to follow him, Dave Hamilton. If you want to follow Pilot Pete, he's Pilot Pete. And the publication is Mac Observer.
Lastly, but not leastly, join Facebook and like us at facebook.com/MacGeekGab. We post all kinds of things there, including events for these live shows. But of course, you don't have to join us for the live show. It is fun. We have a good time. We have a good group here in the chat room, a good group of regulars, and then several people that just come in and join us sort of ad hoc. And it makes for a nice little, subsection of the Mac Geekab family. It's a very welcoming place. MacGeekab.com/stream is where that happens. All right, John. Let's move this one out. Sound good? I do want to thank Michael Johnston from both the We Have Communicators podcast as well as GetAppler.com for converting this show into AAC and adding all those chapters. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, hosts the show and pushes the bandwidth from us to you. Podcast Marketplace includes BB Edit, as we mentioned, Text Expander, and PDF Pen from Smile, Gazelle, of course, to sell your stuff, Squarespace, host your stuff, and now Audible at audiblepodcast.com/MGG. All through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. John, do you have any? I'm traveling tomorrow, and I have to travel out of Boston, and Boston is back on track now. But do you have any advice for me, perhaps? And advice we could share with everyone for the week.
Well, especially if you're in the airport, Dave, I would say, don't get caught.
Made up.